welcome to another edition of the Fordcast, which is a little bit different today because we have a special guest. Hi, Crystal.
Hi.
So many of you who've listened to a couple of our episodes may know that Crystal Beth has been a frequent guest on the show.
I have. I like Harrison Ford, so it works
She does,
out.
Yes. And so little special thing is we've actually invited her on to be a special guest host. So you are, I'm comparing you to the Joan Rivers.
Oh, wowie.
To Rachel's Johnny Carson.
That's amazing. I'll take it.
Will you take it?
Yeah, that is a great label. I hope I can live up to it. And I have the, I'm no Rachel, that's for damn sure. So.
No, of course not. And you're not replacing Rachel.
No, Rachel's still here, well, alive. I'm just an extra voice while she does her life.
Yeah, so once a month, instead of Rachel, you may get, like today, the voice of Crystal Beth.
Yeah.
To talk about Harrison Ford. And we're going to go through the next 10 years of Harrison's Ford. I'm drunk. I'm doing the podcast drunk. But apparently the drunk of like a fake 1950s drunk.
Yeah. Ooh. Well, if anyone listens to any podcast I do, they know that I love to drink on them. So maybe you are actually drunk.
Hey, Sarah Bareilles, I believe, has like some whiskey when she performs, right?
Yeah.
It's supposed to be very like soothing on your throat. Why don't you, if perhaps this is the first time that those listening have heard the sweet sounds of your voice, Crystal Beth, why don't you tell them about yourself and what other podcasts you do?
Well, I do a lot of podcasts. So I have two of my own. One of them is The Fifth Element, which is a Movies by Minutes podcast about the fifth element, where we talk about the movie 1 minute at a time. And I also do a video game podcast called Unlimited Lives Radio, which is a podcast about video games that I record with a couple of other New York City comedians. And Movies by Minutes, what I had mentioned before, is kind of this own its own weird subculture in podcasts. And there's a whole bunch of them. And I have been a guest on quite a few of them. So I'm talking about movies all the time. So this is nice to be. I'm talking about movies all the time for 5 minutes of the movie at a time. So it's very nice to be able to talk about a whole movie.
Yes. It's funny when I explain to people who are not sort of in the podcasting world or listen to podcasts, and then I get to the point where I explain the minute sort of genre, and their eyes just kind of like roll up to the back of, not maybe roll up to the back of their heads, but they look at me like, what?
Yeah, they're very confused.
Yeah, they get very, what do you mean a minute? I was like, well, they go through it, and well, no, I understand that, but wait, what?
Is every episode a minute? Like, no, the episodes, we'll talk about 1 minute of a movie for anywhere between 12 and an hour minutes.
Yeah. And it actually, you get really good episodes.
Yeah. And you, when you look at a movie like that, you start to notice the tiniest little things everywhere. And it's like IMD trivia on drugs.
that's good. That should be your tagline.
Yeah.
Yeah. Put that on the poster.
Yeah, I should.
Yeah. It's also good that you're here today because you've guested many times on the Indiana Jones Minute.
I have. I'm actually recording with them again soon.
Where are they? What are they on?
They're on the third one.
Oh, that's my favorite.
Yeah, me too.
So if anyone hasn't guessed, we are on Indiana Jones in the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull with Crystal Beth.
Yeah!
Yay! directed by someone named Steven Spielberg. Not familiar.
No. Has he done other things?
Maybe. We'll have to look him up.
Yeah. Okay. We'll find out throughout the episode, imagine.
Music is by someone named John Williams.
A basic name.
It is a basic name. I hope he's not a basic person. And written by, and I hope I say his name right, is that David Coip? Coip?
Looks right to me. Cope?
Cope, maybe?
Maybe Cope.
It's not that I'm doing research, is that as a dyslexic, sometimes it's hard to pronounce names I've never heard out loud, and writers' names are not said out loud.
They're not.
It's terrible. You could watch a million videos and no one names the writer.
Nope. It's also bad at names because I don't know how the letters go together. For names.
Welcome to
it
my
could
life.
Go anywhere.
It was released May 18th, 2008, and actually premiered at the Cannes Film Festival. This does not feel like a Cannes Film Festival kind of a movie.
No, it doesn't.
I guess it was a prestige movie, so they felt like.
They were like, well, it's been 20 years since one came out, so why not?
And something that I found out, I don't know if you know this, Crystal Beth, but apparently during the 1970s, George Lucas and Steven Spielberg made a deal for 5 Indiana Jones films.
Wow.
So that's a long contract that's finally coming to fruition. That really took me by surprise. I don't remember. And who knows? again, I forget things because I'm doing so many podcasts that you could go back and listen to the episode for Raiders of the Lost Ark, and I probably said that. And just like totally forgot.
I wonder if you don't use your contract for a while, you think it becomes void and they had to start a new one?
Well, it must be because no one thought they were going to do another
dusted
one.
Dusted it off and they were like, nope, see, two more.
Because apparently George Lucas decided that three was sort of a good number. He couldn't think of any more stories. I mean, I remember when this finally was about to come out and Vanity Fair had this huge article, you know, Annie Leibovitz is always the first one on set and they have those pictures. And the whole article is about how they just couldn't figure out the MacGuffin, which is the first time I'd ever heard the word MacGuffin. So I was like, what is this word? This is fascinating. He thought that doing the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles was going to be more interesting, like going backwards.
And Young Indiana Jones Chronicles were great.
I loved them. But watching them as an adult, it feels a little preachy. Like, this is a kid show teaching you about history.
Oh, yeah. But when you're a kid, you don't notice that. So.
No, I didn't. No, I loved it. And I think I had a little crush on the guy who played Indy.
Yeah, who didn't? Indiana Jones, just across the board, it doesn't matter how old he is. He's yummy. Just smart action men.
Yes, no. My joke always is that I have to pick Indiana Jones over Han Solo because he's got tenure.
Yeah, Harrison Ford, out of all of the people he's ever played, Indiana Jones is the one fictional character where I'm like, that would be my, I don't even want to say husband. I'd probably get sick of him. But that would be one of my flings. He's always away. It's the best kind of husband, though. Some people marry military guys so often.
I wonder, though, if it wasn't Marion, like, would he pick a wife where she wouldn't know about his other life?
Maybe he's selfish enough to not want to say anything about it. Like, he's like...
Because no one really seems to know. I mean, I feel like even... Marcus, right? I feel like Marcus doesn't really get it until he sees it, right? Like...
Yeah.
He's mild-mannered professor guy.
Just a professor guy. Girl's got the crushes on him, and that's it. Yeah, I don't know. I just don't think he would marry anyone else.
Yeah.
And that's why he didn't.
Probably. He's too private, too busy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're going to go into the discussion, and we are lucky enough to have Stephen Kent from Beltway Banthas to come and talk to us about Crystal Skull.
I'm excited to meet him.
Let's go. All right, so mystery guest, please introduce yourself. That's you, Stephen.
Hey there, Stephen Kent. Hey there, Stephen Kent from Beltway Banthas.
And Stephen, you particularly asked to be on this episode. I believe you called yourself a Crystal Skull apologist.
Yeah, I would say I'm something of a soft apologist for the movie. I think, like most things, fans are overdramatic about how bad certain properties are. And Crystal Skull sort of gets a lot of that, I think, in the same way that the prequels and Star Wars get some over-the-top criticism and hate. I think it's a fine movie with some weird oddities throughout the film that are kind of downers. But for the most part, yeah, I try to defend this movie because people and their negative feedback loops, man. Like, it always just gets so intense.
Yeah, I'm over here nodding my head in agreement where Crystal Skull is hands down my least favorite of all of the Indiana Jones movies. But every time I watch it, because I only remember the bad things because that's only what people talk about.
That's true.
I'll watch it and be like, that was funny. That was fun. And that gave me the feels and that didn't. And there's a couple points in this. Like, this movie especially, I can watch. And I've seen it enough times now where I'll just fast forward the parts I don't like. And you can skip about 30 minutes of the movie and not miss a thing.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the movie is fun, right? And I think we all sort of grade these things on a curve to a certain extent. And when we say that it's, you know, the least favorite or our least favorite of all the Indiana Jones movies, you know, that's probably true. It is not the best of the films. Out of the four, it is at the bottom. But when you talk about an action adventure, you know, searching for a treasure or lost item sort of genre movie, it's better than anything out there, just in terms of that kind of film. And it's fun. And there's all these high points and low points of the movie. And if you trim out, again, you said like 30 minutes, you know, I'd say probably like 15 to 20. It's a great film. So we just sort sort of like, we sort of judge it based on like, we want to love it as much as we did Raiders of the Lost Ark when we were kids, and it's never going to be that for us. But left alone, it's fine.
Yeah. Own thing.
It's, I have to say, movie. I was surprised. I actually have not seen it since I saw it in theaters.
Really?
I was very disappointed. to say the least. I mean, literally, I think when they're through the jungle with the monkeys, with the bad CGI, I started screaming in my head, just talk to each other. Like, please, you're related now. You found out that, just talk. Please just talk. Like,
no, they're men.
I understand that. They're men, but there was too much action. Like, it felt to me like they were taking what had been a staple in the 80s and trying to update it, as opposed to just making an Indiana Jones movie. So there wasn't a lot of character development for me, and there was too much action. But that being said, seeing it again, I was pleasantly surprised how much of it I actually did enjoy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And, you know, we do focus on the negatives, right? So, you know, it comes down to the monkeys and the refrigerator scene. And so I actually watched The Crystal Skull twice last month, like twice in the same week, just because I sat down to watch it by myself because I couldn't sleep one night. And then the next day, my daughter happened to want to watch it. So I watched it twice. And the refrigerator scene just plays such an outsized role in commentary about this movie, where if you blink, the scene is over. He gets into the refrigerator. He gets blown through the sky. He falls out, and it's done. It takes up literally 30 seconds of the movie, and it's all we talk about. And there's so much ridiculous crap that goes on in Indiana Jones 1-3, and we get so hung up about this refrigerator. I just don't understand it anymore.
I agree. It is sort of out there and crazy and like, oh yeah, that won't actually probably be real. But it lines in with the sense of humor of the films. The fact that the hat is always falling back and that he's able to, you know, keep it. That, to me, fell into the humor of the film. It is odd, you know, and I really appreciate that they really went sort of headlong into the 50s with the music. And as much as I don't like Shia LaBeouf in the film, him sort of being like Marlon Brando in The Wild One, you know, in his outfit and... The opening with the drag racing, like it's I mean, I like the 50s and the 60s. Yeah. You know, so and obviously Spielberg, you know, having grown up, you know, is very much entrenched in that. Now I forget where I was going with this, but
the refrigerator, you liked it.
That's it.
Or you didn't hate it.
I was indifferent to it, but I feel like it fell sort of into sort of this, you know, this thing. Now, if we are going to talk about the 50s in a way as well, is I can defend the fact that it is aliens as much as I also hate it. Oh, yeah. Because I see what he's doing. If the original movies were the serials of the 1930s and you have the Nazis, and then the 50s is all about B-movies because that's what the genre was, I so appreciate that that's what they were doing. But there's no mysticism to me in Aliens.
Well, I think that there definitely is. I mean, there's the History Channel today is all just about how aliens apparently were at the foundations of all of our history. And it actually seems very appropriate for an Indiana Jones movie in retrospect, where I think I was in the camp when this movie first came out that, oh my gosh, Indiana Jones does not chase aliens. This is absurd. And then I sort of go back and I, you know, you have two movies with a foundation of religion. Mm-hmm. And then you have one movie in the Temple of Doom, which is about the occult. And this movie is also sort of about, in a way, the occult, the idea that the aliens built the pyramids. And this sort of is an underpinning of a lot of the 20th century. Like, even like, you know, Hitler and Stalin were all interested in these kinds of things. So why wouldn't Indiana Jones sort of operate in that same sort of universe?
That's exactly what I was thinking as well when we were talking about this. And I think that the thing with the aliens that really bugs people is now Indiana Jones now looks different than Indiana Jones that was made in the 80s because mm-hmm. it's made 20 years later. So when you see aliens in this movie, everything's flashier and looks newer and
that's
cooler.
True.
But that's because they had the technology to be able to do it. And if they had that back in, can you imagine what the Last Crusade would look like if they had the visual effects they had now?
Mm-hmm.
It'd probably be incredibly silly looking. And mm-hmm. especially because it was in the 80s too. If they were able to fit like this technology in with the 80s, it'd be nuts. And it just happens that it's this new squeaky clean thing where we see rugged old dirty 80s. And it's just like Star Wars, where we have the original Star Wars that's dirty and grungy, but that's also because that's all they could afford and all they had the technology for. And then we got the new Star Wars, which was like new and shiny because they finally know how to do it.
Yeah, but they also were realizing now how much practical effects needs to be in film. And I think that we're sort of leveling out where it was like, we have this shiny new thing. Oh, let's use it because we can. Right. Whereas now you hear so many, you know, like the sense of pride from a director, you know, half of the effects were practical. Mm-hmm. And it's like, yeah. Okay, thank you. But and why are you so proud
too?
Huh?
Those are the ones that hold
up. Yes. So it's like, I think that, you know, everything does that, right? Society does that where, you know, you kind of go full out really high and then you realize, oh, wait, we got to level out here. So I do think that it was at a time when it was a little too flashy. Whereas nowadays people are realizing you can combine practical effects with CGI and it just looks better and it stays more classic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Imagine the finale of that movie if they had reined it in a little bit and the aliens, when they finally show up at the conclusion of the movie, don't look like Kaminoans from Star Wars Episode II. Yeah. It was so over the top and you just sort of felt like you were taken out of this movie, which had been happening around sets and it's sort of a temple structure like you might have seen in the Mummy movies. And then all of a sudden you feel like you're in Star Wars and that ship takes off and just obliterates the entire surrounding area. And it just looks like a video game. It looks awful.
It does.
And mm-hmm. I ache for a version of this movie where they had the Force Awakens approach to classic effects and simplicity. And those aliens had actually been like, you know, puppets or robotic. The movie would have felt a lot better and they missed that opportunity.
Yeah. Or actual rocks falling instead of
actual rocks.
Actual rocks, but
yeah,
like actual rocks falling and landing and killing everyone. Like,
oh my
actual
gosh.
Death.
Wow.
Can I actually throw in there that I thought it was hilarious that The Last Jedi, which did such a great job on balancing their special effects, the worst special effect in the entire movie of The Last Jedi was when Rey lifted the rocks at the finale of the movie to let everybody out of the cave on Crate. Mm-hmm. That was the fakest looking part of the entire movie. And I'm just like, guys, can we not animate rocks? This is the most simple.
They were running out of time.
We can do.
Yes, that's so funny because that's something that was always been in the back of my mind about that too, especially because in Empire Strikes Back, those floating rocks looked real good. So maybe stick with that.
And I think also the contrast with the end of the movie is the beginning of the movie, which is something that really struck me as I was watching it again for the first time since I saw it in the theater, was the colors, the cinematography at the opening is so beautiful with the reds and the beautiful sort of, you know, New Mexico background. It sort of feels like the beginning of Back to the Future 3? I mean, it's probably, they probably filmed it in the same place, but, and I remember thinking, oh, wow, this, I had forgotten sort of how beautiful this is. I mean, Spielberg's a wonderful director, but, and then the end is so over the top.
Ridiculous.
It's kind of takes out of it.
And they just sit on top of the thing and they're like, well, we're stuck here. Why? Because we can't go into the jungle at night. Like, you just literally fought supernatural beasts and you're like, nope, jungle's scary. Scary stuff. So earlier we had mentioned that two things that people find frustrating were the refrigerator scene and the, what was the other thing we said?
The monkeys.
The monkeys. Oh, yeah. See, I try to block that completely out of my mind. The thing for me that bugged me most in this whole movie was the runner of the stupid effing gopher.
Yeah, that was.
I hate that runner so much. I don't think it's funny. I don't think it's
funny.
Cute. And it's. So not Indiana Jones in my mind.
It reminds me of everything you hear about, not Groundhog's Day, Caddyshack, that the people behind the scenes were like, can we have more of the groundhog? The groundhog's funny. And they're like, no, we don't want a puppet in this damn movie. It's a comedy, but not like for kids. No, we want more of the puppet. Like, I don't know who
I
thought that
less
was funny.
Gopher. If there was no gopher,
they
the
look
monkeys,
fake. They also look really as fake as the monkeys. Interesting enough, Spielberg recently has taken credit for, and I feel like he's just doing it to take the sort of, you know, fire off of someone else, but who knows? He says that the refrigerator was his idea and he takes the blame for it.
I mean, he's not really taking a lot of blame, because I think that we can all agree that the refrigerator wasn't that big of a deal for me. I think that he, I think it seemed like they painted themselves into a corner where they were like, oh no, well, let's see, instead of rewriting this, where could he go? Into a refrigerator, perfect, but refrigerators were lead lined, so they could do that.
Yeah.
But that's a really long, hard fall. But it's also, this is where people need to remind themselves that they're watching movies.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I kind of just resent the idea that they should have to apologize for anything. This is the same series of movies where Indiana Jones drank a cup of blood and then became entranced in some sort of blood ritual and had to be hit with fire in order to snap out of it.
His father was shot, and then they poured some water on it, and he lived. It closed up the wound.
The bullet didn't even hop out. The internal damage is not accounted for. There's just a bullet sitting inside of him. Know. You know, they don't have to apologize for anything. No. Fans just need to remember that this is not reality.
You know, something that I was reminded watching it again is that they sort of very lightly talk about kind of the Red Scare in a way. You know, he loses his job. And I wish that that had been something that was a bigger part of the film.
There's not enough time.
There's not enough time. Obviously, he has to go on an adventure, you know. But there were so many little things that I almost wonder if, like, in other drafts had been, like, a bigger part of the pie. Like, I get it's the Cold War. Of course, the Nazis are not going to be the bad guys. It's going to be the Russians.
Right.
Yeah, but I think it would be a little odd if they focus too much on that, because that's just the backdrop of the entire movie. And, you know, kind of like with Raiders of the Lost Ark, we have to know, like, the geopolitics of why Indiana Jones is going abroad, why that's such urgency to get his hands on the Lost Ark before the Germans do. So if they focus too much on, like, the Red Scare and the Soviets in the United States, you wouldn't get your adventure, I feel like.
Right. Yeah, no, I just meant that I felt like there was a little more potential in this film. Like, we were talking very briefly beforehand, is originally it was going to be a daughter. And my heart sort of aches for that missing opportunity. And not just as being a woman, but, like, you have a contrast. If he has a daughter, considering the kind of person in the age that he is from, Indiana Jones, having a daughter who's adventurous would be a conflict for him.
Yeah.
And that would be interesting. As opposed to just this kid who at the end of it, he finds out is his son and he should go to the conflict is he should go to school.
Yeah.
Like,
but I thought you said, don't let anyone tell me what to do. He's like, that's before I realized I was your father.
Yeah.
Which I got to say is one of the best parts of the movie. I think, like,
the quicksand scene is one of my favorite parts. It's so funny.
The scene in the back of the truck when they're tied up is the best, like, Indiana Jones argument that has been had on camera, I think, in a couple of movies. Like, that is such a great line of banter between him and the future Mrs. I'm blanking on the character's name.
Marion
Ravenwood.
Marion Ravenwood.
There are a lot of Marys, kid.
So many Marys in his life.
Don't talk about
my mom that way. Oh, I love that. But no, I think this the way that they sort of brought the conflict down between him and Shia LaBeouf Buff to just, like, what a parent wants for their child is, you know, the idea of getting an education and going far in life and all that. And then, like, he sort of fakes that when he doesn't know that it's his own son. So I don't know. That felt very real. And I like that bit.
Well, those are two really good scenes, I have to say, and was reminded watching it again. And I love the fact that it's a little cheesy that he just gives her a line like, they weren't you, honey. And she's like 16 again.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So you get all fluttery and cute. One of my favorite parts, every time I watch it, it makes me laugh out loud so hard. And it is the part, it's tiny. It's right when they're originally going into the grave to find the skull for the first time. Mm-hmm. And Shia LaBeouf's kind of losing his mind because he's confused and he just attacked by a bunch of things. And
I think I know what's coming up.
Runs into the little nugget of earth that's stuck to a spider web and it hits him in the cheek and he jumps back and he points at it and he's like, oh, it's just a thing.
Oh, see, I love when he goes, you're a teacher? And he goes, part-time.
Yeah, that part is funny.
I love jokes like that.
Shia's funny. He's a good comedic actor and he finds the littlest things.
Yeah, see, that's the issue. I don't think it's his fault. I feel he was miscast.
Yeah, his character, so he overacts, I think, in the beginning of the movie, but I think that's because they were giving him, like you said earlier, Marlon Brando 1950s script, where he sort of had to act like a 1950s style actor.
Yeah, he watched all of his movies, apparently, in like preparation. Blackboard Jungle, I think is the name of it, like The Wild Ones. Like, he watched a whole bunch of stuff in that they asked him to, and you know. But I think also as a character, like, it fit to me because Mutt is sort of putting on this persona. He wants to be tough, but he's not.
Mm-hmm. He's not. He's a little, he should be a little nerd, and he knows it.
Yeah.
And that's why he's acting like this. He's like, no, I'm super tough.
I also love the fact that he gave himself a nickname that is like a dog, and Indy is named after the dog. Like, I love little subtle things like that, you know, and that he's a mutt because he's like the mutt of the two of them. I thought the little subtle things like that were really great. And I always love the idea of someone who has sort of a different persona. Like, with superheroes, I'm more interested in like who they are when they're not the superhero, funny enough. So you have, you know, Mutt is sort of his persona that he's putting on, just like Indiana Jones is sort of the persona that Henry is putting on. And there's a subtle little moment where he's trying to get Ox to remember who he is.
Oh, I was just thinking about
that part.
It's
so beautiful because he's about to say, like, he tries to say Indiana, and then he kind of pauses and very softly, like, so that they can't hear. He's like, Henry. Like, he's trying to remind him, but, like, not let everyone know, like, that's who he really is. Like, it's sort of such a great little moment.
Yeah.
I also have to say, though, the first time I saw it, I didn't, because, again, I haven't seen it since, I kept thinking that William Hurt as Ox was not his contemporary, but was, like, his mentor. And it's so how my brain just doesn't compute the fact that they're the same. I mean, William Hurt is a little bit older. A little bit older than Harrison Ford, but they could play contemporaries because it's not that. William Hurt was 77 when he passed away. I looked that up. And so they could still be technically contemporaries.
Yeah, William Hurt's only 2 years older.
Yeah, there you go. So
I mean, John Hurt, William Hurt, please.
Yeah. What, did I say John Hurt by accident?
No, John Hurt's his name. I said William Hurt originally.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
Oh, maybe I may have said William Hurt by accident.
We're thinking about Mutt Williams right now.
Yeah, that's why. Too many Williams, And anyway, I thought that was so funny that in my brain, I didn't see Harrison Ford and him as being the same generation.
Yeah.
And it's so obvious that they are. Because he says they went to school together, but I missed that. I guess I was focused. The monkeys distracted me.
It was the monkeys. Well, the monkeys are after it, so you have no excuse.
Yeah, that's true.
But there's also a part where we get to see Mutt's relationship with Oxley, where he's really upset. And you can see that he's almost crying when he's talking with, like, trying to get Ox to remember who he is. He's, like, sitting down in front of him and just kind of looking at him in the face. He's almost crying. It's really sweet because this is his dad. This is the man that raised him. It's helping him to become
Mutt
a man.
Mutt didn't really have a dad, and this guy was. In fact, I was surprised when, at the end, he doesn't know that Mutt is Indy's kid. I assumed that he knew. Doesn't she say, didn't you know why he stopped talking to you?
Well, that's what I thought too. And I was like, well, maybe he didn't know and was just mad that he wasn't talking to Marion on principle. And maybe
he just left Marion. Yeah.
Yeah.
As opposed to, although it seems a bigger deal if he left her pregnant.
Right. And I feel like if Oxley did know that Indy was the father of Mutt, he wouldn't have let him leave. There would have been like a struggle.
That's true.
And he wouldn't have not told him. Indiana Jones would have found out that that was his son because
they
respect each other and they want each of them to be the best version of themselves.
Yeah.
So there's no chance.
That's sort of a sad thing. I'd love to see their relationship. Like, it's too bad that they had not had that character in the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles and we could have seen them like go to school together.
Right.
Oh, there's actually a moment, I don't know if you guys know, because I was super into the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, and I am a bit older than you guys, but the Pancho Villa reference is an episode of Young Indiana Jones.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I believe that puts it in canon.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But unfortunately, they've taken out all of the old indie stuff for streaming and DVD, in which he has a daughter, in which he lived to be 90. And I didn't see it then, but like now that he's getting older, I'm like, yeah, I believe that that might be Harrison Ford when he's like 95. A little glint in the eye.
There are certain parts where, and especially in this movie, Harrison Ford when he's talking, he gets his tight-lipped sassafras chat way more than any other of the movies. And I'm just like, he's so crotchety. And there's points where I'm like, you're kind of being mean. And I'm trying to remember exact specific point. Man, I just watched it this morning, too.
Well, you know, he refused to dye his hair. They wanted him to not have the gray hair. And he was like, nope, this is who Indy is.
Good for him.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, that's awesome. Good for you, Harrison. No, I think we all need a little bit more of Harrison Ford in the film business just to make it all a little bit more grounded and down to earth.
Yes. Yeah, I told someone yesterday that he was 75 and they paused. This is a young girl and she paused and she went, he's looking good. And I said,
he is,
yeah,
looking good.
He's looking good. You forget that he's 75.
I forgot he was 75. I thought he was in his 60s.
No.
Holy cow.
I guess you didn't listen to our special, 75 years of Harrison Ford.
Oh my gosh, 75 years.
That's insane.
Yikes. It's
insane. Well, and his father lived to be in his 90s, so I think we're going to see a lot of him. And considering how many times he's broken his body and he can still walk, like, that's a healthy guy.
How is he so handsome?
Genetics.
I don't think that's true, because look at his son. His son's not handsome, but like...
I mean, you could say it's the half-Jew. I'm a little biased, but you know, that could be a thing. Although it's so funny to me, because I think his brother looks like an old Jew. Like, and so you, in fact, apparently people used to joke that like one of them was the, when they were both young, that one of them, their father was the milkman, because they looked so different. So I guess I can't really say that, because it could just be like Harrison looks more Irish and his brother looks more Jewish. But there's parts of Harrison Ford that remind me of my dad. Like, not the whole thing, because my dad does not look like Harrison Ford.
Well, you've seen.
Oh, yes. We talk about this on the show all the time. See, if you have not heard Crystal Beth on the show before, Stephen, her father looks like Harrison Ford.
Yeah, which is real weird that I find Harrison Ford so attractive. It really puts me in a bad spot.
That's a lot of therapy.
Yeah. But my dad is not Harrison Ford, so I can still have a crush on Harrison Ford.
I agree.
Because my dad's name is Vance.
It'd be funny.
It's allowed.
He was
allowed.
Harrison Ford, and he was just living his life, you know, he had double life.
It's disgusting.
Sorry. Well. I forgot about the sort of the implications of that.
But yeah, I think that I agree with Stephen with... People get into these negative wormholes where everyone just festers in everything they hate, as opposed to finding the things that they do love about certain things in movies that you should just love. Because and Steven, this is something I always talk about when I talk about the prequels. I am an apologist for them. But I don't even like using the word apologist, just like you said, because I don't think that anything needs to be apologized for, because the person that invented this world wanted to do that. That is what this world is.
That's what I think.
It's not my world.
Exactly.
It's his world. He could do whatever the heck he wants, because it's his universe and he's making it for us, but it's not our, like, he doesn't need to listen to a word I say. If he wants shiny spaceships and midichlorians, he gets it. If they want a refrigerator that can fly through the air with a guy that doesn't turn into a bag of broken bones in it and monkeys that swing through trees with young boys, that's this world. That's what it is. And there's aliens in it. And that's awesome. I think that something that I always wonder about with the Crystal Skull is if the aliens were... Because we know that there's... I like the idea that there's aliens somewhere. It's really fun and really cool. And I would have liked if they did it without us actually seeing the aliens.
Yeah.
And it became more of a hallucinatory thing where Kate Blanchett's character, she, like, we saw the skull and the skull was there and everything, but we never saw the actual alien.
I agree.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. I mean, they sort of took out a little bit of the mystery and, you know, eliminated the opportunity for us to imagine what extraterrestrials might look like. And, you know, for me, like... Indiana Jones just sort of like gets me and keeps up with where I am about what I think about the universe and the world, because, you know, I am someone who I believe in the Judeo-Christian God, and I also believe in aliens. I believe in all of it, and Indiana Jones does too. And so I am always like, this gets me, like, this is the world that I believe in, and it's Indiana Jones and he's seen it all. And I just kind of wish that they kept some things a little bit more subtle, which they did in Raiders of the Lost Ark, I think, quite well.
I agree. You need to have that sense of doubt.
Yes.
Because that's what Indiana Jones is. He's both. He's a skeptic and he believes.
Yeah.
At the same time, almost.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, he has to be reconvinced every movie of the possibilities, which I think is odd.
Yeah. But that's, yeah. Oh, there you go. But that's the conflict, right? Like everything has to have a conflict within the character as well as within the story that they're fighting towards.
Yeah, you know, Indiana Jones, he's like that wonderful cross between an academic and a spiritualist where he lives in his books and he sort of comes from the university mindset. So it makes him, again, like that skeptic. No, but I mean, he just has to be reconvinced every movie of what's possible. And I think that that's sort of, again, like the human part of the human story is no matter how many miracles and wonders we see, we always are still just cynical and negative. And Indiana Jones just wraps all that up nicely.
Yeah, I think I'm kind of like that too. It's like I want to believe, but I also am the person who needs proof, and I have a brain, and he's an academic. And what does he become at the end? He's the assistant dean.
Yeah. Associate dean.
Associate dean. That's right. Yeah. In fact, I wrote down all of his things. Colonel Dr. Professor Henry Indiana Jones Jr., Associate Dean.
That's awesome.
I love titles.
He has
America's Dean. I love it.
Yeah.
There's the one part that always sticks out to me in the movie as being very OG Indiana Jones.
What?
Is when the fire starts coming out of Cate Blanchett's eyes at the end.
Oh.
It looks OG Indiana Jones. Well, and feels like
well, you know what that
like,
scene reminded me of? Is that...
Grievous. Grievous. General Grievous's death.
But the scene reminds me of the fact that the villains in most of these movies are done in by their own greed.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what you get. Don't be greedy.
Yeah. I mean, even his friend, who I also wish that we... I wish that there was more of a relationship and that I cared about this guy being good or bad.
Mac.
Mac, yeah, I didn't know who Mac was. I didn't remember Mac until I was like, oh, yeah. When I was reading the cast, I was like, who did this Ray guy play? Who was that?
And yeah, that was strange, right?
Yeah, and I don't think it's the actor's fault.
No, also, don't make him like a quadruple crosser.
Quadruple agent. You never knew. And it made it really, really hard to keep up with. Like, he double crosses again at the end. That's just not good writing.
Yeah, but if you cared about the character, like, I always say his name wrong. Salih?
Yeah.
Right? Like, not that he would cross Indy, but like, if it had been a character like that, that you like got to know and cared about, and then all of a sudden he changed, even when Allison Duty's character, right? Even though we kind of don't really love her, when you find out that she's on the other side, it's like, oh.
Yeah.
And I didn't have that feeling with this guy. Maybe because it happened so early.
Right. I was like, okay, he's a bad guy.
Yeah, yeah. And then
I was like, oh, he's a good guy. And I was like, oh, he's a bad guy.
Yeah, I thought what was funny about Mac was in the very beginning when he betrays Indiana Jones for the first time, he just says, I'm a capitalist and they pay. And so like right there, you sort of get the Steven Spielberg view of the world that, you know, if you're a capitalist, you don't have any morals, no grounding, you just follow the money. And apparently it's not just you're a traitor and you're greedy. It's I'm a capitalist and this is where the money is. And there you get Mac. And so he'll not double cross you, but triple cross you, and maybe even a quadruple to top it off.
So something interesting about this film is that it is the only Indiana Jones film to be filmed exclusively in the United States.
Oh, wowee.
Now, I'm sure that had to do with money.
USA.
Okay. No? Okay.
But even the Amazon stuff was in Hawaii.
Obviously.
And I actually was kind of on the set, but not really on the set.
How were you kind of? One foot in, 1 foot out?
So they filmed all the Marshall College stuff at Yale.
Uh-huh.
If you can't tell. And I was an extra for 3 weeks in a movie called The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants Part 2.
Ah!
Legendary Part 2.
Part 2. I was featured. You can see me. I was Kyle MacLachlan's assistant, and I followed him around. He was lovely. He would always be like, learn your lines, guys. It's very funny. So we were up there
for the extras.
Well, we were playing his assistants.
And he kept saying, learn your lines?
No, he said it once.
A clever man.
He also would just all of a sudden do Shakespeare out of nowhere. He was very nice to us. I'm just saying he was nice, considering that we were technically extras. But it was like a 3-day shoot that became 3 weeks. And I knew that they were filming. So like the bus come up and I'm like looking out and I could see what was probably the set, but I couldn't see anything. And we weren't allowed to obviously like roam around. And then one night at like 3 a.m., Shia LaBeouf walks in.
Oh man.
He just decides to hang out with some of the girls wearing a 7-Up shirt. I remember that. He seemed nice. Didn't talk to him. Just was like, turn around. Oh, Shia LaBeouf. I was super tired.
Can we pause for a sec to lament, like, really how sad the loss of Shia LaBeouf as, like, a normal functioning human is?
Yes. Sure. I feel like, though, I didn't grow up with him away. Probably you guys and Even Stevens, right? Like,
so he didn't see. I was a little older.
Okay.
Watching Even Stevens.
Okay. So I don't have that connection to him as, like, I mean, I think it's sad when any human goes off the rails. But I guess it's the way that I feel about Lindsay Lohan. And I was like, oh, she had so much potential.
Yeah, and, you know, they saw potential in him, too. You know, I just remember the magazine covers and the interviews with LaBeouf, Spielberg, and Harrison Ford, and they all had their hands on his shoulders.
He was, like, their first choice.
Yeah, and, you know, there was just all this talk about the passing of the mantle and the passing of the hat. And Harrison Ford described him as, you know, the up-and-coming next great, like, action movie character or actor that he was. And Shia LaBeouf... I don't know. He either just rebelled against it or got lost somewhere else. But I've just always been sad whenever I see his name in the news and he pops up, because it always feels like he's going to come back and then he never does.
Yeah. Well, look at Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah.
I mean, that was obviously drugs. We don't know what's happening with Shia. It could just be too much power at once can, you know, really mess you up.
Yeah.
So who knows? You know, I think you need to have hope for any human being. That they're gonna come back.
I think that if he pulled himself back out of it, he would do well. And I don't know if he'd keep doing movies though.
Well, isn't he even doing like performance art now too?
But I think he would be like, I'm done with just
have a good life.
Right.
Yeah, and you know, and that's like not to say like being a movie star is the highest and happiest calling. Like maybe he really was miserable, and if that's the case, then like I wish you the best on your next whatever thing is. But he doesn't seem happy currently either. He seems like a masochist, and it's just kind of a little bizarre to watch.
Yeah, it is.
He's like a Joaquin Phoenix light.
Yeah, but Joaquin Phoenix hasn't really gone off the rails that much, has he? I mean, of course,
he's a little crazy town.
Yeah, but he seems to be a upstanding citizen crazy town as opposed to being arrested crazy town.
Yeah, that's true.
I guess that's what I mean. Like, he doesn't seem to be ruining his life. He's just a little crazy.
He's just a weirdo.
Yeah, which we all are, really. So
he makes me feel normal.
Yeah, I guess there's that. But on a lighter note, there were rumors that if it was going to be a girl, that Natalie Portman might play.
Oh, that would be so boring.
But that was the rumor. And again, this never really got out of like a very early draft. In fact, I don't know if you guys are interested, but I have a little timeline here. And apparently drafts have been written since 1993.
Wowie.
Which is sort of crazy. So the first story was written by Jeb Stuart, who wrote The Fugitive. Then in 95, his script became Indiana Jones and the Saucer Men from Mars, which took place in 1949. And Willie was in it, and Marion and Short Round had cameos. Because Lucas was sort of obsessed for a while of like Indiana getting married. And that would have sort of also brought in Henry Sr., which we know eventually the part was too small. And Sean Connery said no. Although that came out very recently, which is... I don't know why it came out now. Then in 96, they hired The Last Crusade writer. But it was so sort of encruxed in alien invasion that Independence Day came out. And Spielberg was like, I don't want to do that.
Right.
And then Lucas focused on the prequels. But then in 2000, M. Night Shyamalan was hired, intended for a 2002 release. But he said he couldn't get Spielberg, Ford, or Lucas to focus on it at all.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I mean, listen, if you were getting, like, scripts, like, since the 90s, you were probably like, I'm done.
I don't care.
Yeah. Because Ford talks about it. He's like, every once in a while, you read a script, but, like, one person wouldn't be happy. And we couldn't do it unless everyone was happy. Then in 2002, Frank Darabont, who wrote various episodes of Young Indiana Jones, was hired to write May 2002, and it was entitled Indiana Jones and the City of Gods, and this was set in the 50s, and they were pursuing ex-Nazis. See, I miss the Nazis. I know it's cliche, but
they're the bad guy of all the world.
Yeah, and you could have them hiding out, you know, that they were doing that. Maybe
yeah,
it's in Argentina.
Come out recently, not to make this political.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you do need to hit the brakes. And they've always, you know, historically they spaced the Nazis out, and I think that gave it a nice good breather.
That's
so that
true.
You really
That's true. The second
you
one
really hungered
happen.
For that
which
super
means,
villain back.
Well, guys, which yeah. means we're now in time for Nazis.
It's time for a Nazi movie.
It's time for Nazis. Well, Spielberg felt that he didn't want to sort of mock Nazis after having done Schindler's List. Now, I am in the Mel Brooks camp. Let's mock the Nazis.
Yeah.
Mock them, mock them. And also, Lucas didn't want to sort of ignore the 1950s Cold War, which I do agree. In 2004, 2005, Jeff Nathanson had Indiana Jones and the Atomic Ants.
Oh, God. Well, they got the ants in.
Yeah. And then David Kopic is credited as the first credit on Crystal Skull. Originally, it was called The Destroyer of Worlds, which is named after the Oppenheimer nuclear bomb.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of people listed. You know, you have story by George Lucas. Jeff Nathanson's, enough of his script was in it that he gets credit. Philip Kaufman is credit for characters, along with Lucas. So there's like a lot of names listed because it went through a lot of different...
Well, it makes sense why there was quadruples, agents and extra giant ants.
Yeah.
And aliens and monkeys and gophers. And every writer was like, I want an animal.
There,
and they put him in.
There is most of a script that you can read. And I can't remember if it's in J.W. Rinsler's book or it's just online, where you have the 13-year-old daughter and Marion is there and there's a double agent, but she's like, engaged to him or married to him. Like, it's like you can see the sort of shades of like what sort of it became. I find it so fascinating. Like, have you ever read the original Revenge of the Jedi draft?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I have.
It's very interesting.
Different.
It's very different.
We did, I did a podcast called The Fifth Element, where he talked about The Fifth Element a lot. And the script that's on Internet Movie Scripts Database is terrible. If they made that movie, they wouldn't have made that movie.
Yeah.
If that was the script it was based on, Lilu's just this angry, jealous woman, and Corbin's like kind of a creep. It's gross. And Zorg's just kind of a slimy space salesman almost. Still a really big bad guy, but it's so interesting how important rewrites are.
Well, I think it's also fascinating in the sense that people don't realize like how long it takes to get a film made, how many, particularly in big movies like this, how many drafts can go through it, and how you could actually probably be a successful screenwriter and maybe not have nothing produced yet.
Uh-huh.
But you're getting paid to do a pass on the script, and they go, you know, we like these parts of it, and we can take this, and WGA says we don't have to give you credit. But if we take this, WGA says we have to. So we're going to take this and maybe not that. And then bye. But you got your money.
Crazy.
It's crazy. I have a friend of mine who's the most successful screenwriter I know. And he maybe hasn't been doing this, but he's been paid to write scripts that maybe just never became anything yet. So no one knows who he is, but he is the most successful screenwriter that I am friends with.
That's so crazy.
Yeah.
Wow. And his screenplays just get put into the vault like in Indiana Jones, and then they can just kind of go in there and draw on them when they need them.
Oh, yeah. So question, just because, again, I don't love this movie and I watched it for the second time in years. We're supposed to assume that the Area 51 is where the Ark is, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they go past it. So all the stuff just goes into Area 51 and they just leave it. So this is the actual big storage container thing from the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what we're meant to believe.
I kind of like the connection.
Oh, it's great. I mean, again, it's kind of like the universe building thing. It's, you know, it's where all the national secrets have to go.
It's a real dangerous building.
I think that makes sense. And, you know, for me, like we mentioned, like the Nazis earlier, I really want them to come back in the next movie.
Yes.
To kind of like the long term, like Nazi conspiracy to get the Ark back or something. Like that would be really cool to kind of come back to that.
It would bring it full circle. And then there would feel like a meaning for a fifth movie.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Right?
Because right now it just feels like sort of like a tail at the end because it's not threes.
You got to button it up.
Yeah, I would like that. I like closure. And I'm a big canon girl. Like, so like you were saying, Crystal Beth, if you say something happens, that's part of the universe and I must find a way to accept it. I can make up my own sort of headcanon to accept it if I have to, but that is the way it is.
Right.
Correctamundo.
They picked it. They do it.
Mm-hmm. Maybe someone misspoke and it's not retcon. You know, like maybe it does connect to this. Maybe they were kidding. I don't know. But for me, I have to make it make sense because I am not the person who created this. You are. And also, I don't want you to do everything that I want to happen or else it's not exciting and it's predictable.
Yeah.
I'm just here to sit and enjoy.
Yeah. I went to a show recently where Usually it's very science-based and you learn a lot. It's actually called Science! Exclamation point, and it is the best improv show in New York City, that hands down.
Exclamation point, amazing.
Yes. It's instead of just getting a suggestion for an improv set, mm-hmm. a scientist gives a lecture.
So it's like ASCAP instead of a comedian. It's a scientist. That's really cool.
And then you do improv based off of the science lecture, mm-hmm. which is super fun. But this last time, they had a woman come in who was just debunking things in movies and how it wouldn't actually work. And I was getting so irrationally mad at her. Because I was like, they describe why it works in the movie. But she was using our science, like from our universe, to make other things not work. And I was like, no. If you want to make anyone more interested, you use the science from our world to make that make sense.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know why it would work, not why it wouldn't work. That's not why I watch movies.
Well, that's the thing that always bugs me when people are like, I didn't like this in this movie because it doesn't make sense. It's science fiction and it's a movie. It makes sense because it happened in the movie.
Yeah, and you can figure out why it made sense by using your damn imagination.
So what do we think of Cate Blanchett in this movie?
Not good.
Yeah.
Not good. You know,
I want to like her because I love her.
I want
her.
To.
But she's not very memorable to me as an Indiana Jones villain, which is sad because there are very few women and it's nice to have a female villain.
Yeah.
I meant to mention something, Stephen. It was interesting that you said about Joseph Stalin, because the whole thing with the mind control that she uses, that idea did come to Lucas because he was fascinated with the fact that Stalin was fascinated with that.
Yeah. No, and that's true. You know, the occult is actually a really important part of World War II and the Cold War. But Cate Blanchett as Colonel Spalko, it sort of seemed like a person trying to act like a Indiana Jones villain instead mm-hmm. of trying to act like the person in which they should be. So, like, you know, if you had like the Nazi characters from the past movies, the only one that was just very strange and quirky was Mr. Black Trenchcoat in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
But he's the best though.
Yeah, but everybody else played their part, particularly like the bad guy in The Last Crusade. They weren't like slapstick characters, and mm-hmm. I thought Cate Blanchett was just like the worst possible cartoonization you could get of a Soviet colonel. And I just didn't buy it. And it just wasn't fun either.
I do love, though, when the ants are crawling up her leg and she kills one between her knees. And I want to think that was the actor, because it's all CGI.
Yeah.
It's not there. So she can pretend that she kills them. And I thought that was so creative. I love that she did that. I mean, it could have been directed, who knows? But I thought that was a pretty nice moment.
She's always interesting and wonderful to watch.
Yeah.
So I don't mind watching her in this movie.
She's gorgeous to look at.
She's beautiful. She's interesting. But I didn't like the character just as a whole.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did like the sword. I thought that was like a cool addition to her character, which made her sort of a wild card. You didn't know like how she was going to attack you or how she was going to fight. But yeah, for the most part, it just felt a little mishandled.
Something interesting, because the last time that Crystal Beth was back was for Hollywood Homicide. Alan Dale is in this movie, who's also in Hollywood Homicide.
Oh, what?
Yes, Alan Dale plays General Ross, who gives us all the exposition about Indy during World War II.
Okay.
And how he was a great hero and that they should let him go after the big scrub down. and he was one of the, I guess, boss cops. That's a terrible, not real phrase. But I've forgotten Hollywood Homicide on purpose because I need other space in my brain. I clawed it out with my fingernails. It's a bad movie, guys.
Do you have any idea how many damn medals this man has won?
I know. Actually, it's kind of good. Like, when he says that, I'm like, I want a movie that was all about him in World War II.
I know.
But also, I love the fact that we get context that, like, okay, the reason we didn't have a movie is because he was off at war.
Yeah, Indiana Jones served. You forget that, the earlier movies, they were kind of before the actual hot war in Europe. It was just sort of the early 30s. So, yeah, there's Indiana Jones doing God knows what out on the battlefield. That would be fun.
That would be so cool to see.
So does everyone want to hear the New York Times review that I cut out? I have a little section here. Here we go. Okay.
I guess.
The New York Times. The original Indiana Jones venture was inspired by Mr. Lucas and Mr. Spielberg's love of 1930s serials, but you'd be hard-pressed to find much inspiration on their latest collaboration. There's plenty of perspiration, of course. But with the wall-to-wall chases, which is what I was a big issue with, many tricked out with obvious computer-generated effects that careen into one another like colliding big rigs. As expected, the high leaps and long jumps look impressive, even if it's something of a bummer when one of the best directors working today, Mr. Spielberg, doesn't seem to be working as hard as the stunt crew.
Uh-oh.
Initially, I thought he was bored with the material. He wouldn't be alone. But now I think he's just grown out of this kind of sticky kid stuff.
It's actually kind of nice.
It is, right? But it's not. Like, that's why I took this section. I thought, huh. Because it's saying what we're saying. It's saying what critics are saying. But it's actually saying a little bit like, well, it's not terrible.
We're out of it.
But it's being a little, like, catty.
Yeah.
Yeah. And but this gives me so much hope for this next movie that they're going to do is because
they have the same writer.
You get they got a nice little like cudgel over the head with the reception to Crystal Skull. And I think that like Star Wars, they're going to course correct and learn some of the lessons that people disliked so much about the Crystal Skull. And then the next one is going to be perfect.
Yeah, I hope that's the case, too. And I hate when movies have my name in it. I hate it so much.
Well, that's why it's so perfect you're joining us.
Yeah, it's just hard. So, like, picture us doing this whole show, and then every once in a while, someone says your name partway through, but then they're not talking about you, and your brain starts thinking that they're asking you a question. Am I the only person that happens to?
No, no, of course. You hear your name, you turn your head.
Yeah.
Steven Spielberg, yes.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah, hello. So the film won the Razzie Award for the worst prequel, remake, or ripoff or sequel of 2009. Well, 2008, but it won in 2009. Listverse.com ranks it the film number 8 on its list of the top 10 worst movie sequels.
Wow.
It was nominated for Best Action Film at the 2009 Critics Circle Awards. Visual Effects Society nominated it for Best Single Visual Effects of the Year. Best Outstanding Matte Paintings. I mean, it was nominated for stuff.
It
was nominated for Saturn Awards, Science Fiction Film Awards, and John Williams won the 51st Grammy Award for Mutt Williams' theme. I was going to say Mutt's theme, and then I halfway through self-corrected that sentence. So it's not, and the critics were mixed. Like they weren't all bad. That surprised me. Like it's not as horribly impressioned as we remember. And again, I was surprised watching it again that it wasn't as terrible as I remember. It has some funny parts. Harrison is quite charming. And is there anything that we haven't talked about that we would like to talk about?
I think I said my piece.
Cover the Nazis, cover the Soviets, covered Shia LaBeouf. We cover the special effects. I feel like that is the Crystal Skull.
Yeah, I got to talk about the hangy thing that I think's hilarious.
Mm-hmm. So that's closing the book on the film, but not on Indiana Jones, because in 2020, it's 2020, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. He will return to us in how many pieces we don't know.
I was just going to say, I was like, you better not fly a plane between now and then.
So I guess the last thing we should just sort of opine on is how do you think they're going to work around the disappearance of actor Shia LaBeouf and then like the major role that he played in the last movie?
He's in college.
Do you think that they're just going to sidestep it and just like they're going to make mention like, oh, he's off in college, blah, 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 move on?
I do.
Yeah.
I think they're going to move on. I mean, obviously he's married to Marion, so there's going to be some reference, you know.
Right.
It's a letter from Mutt. Or,
unless they get divorced and he doesn't speak to his wife and child.
Oh, God,
again.
I hope not. Please, no. Don't
do that.
And
then decides that Willie's daughter is the one he wants to hang out with more.
Yeah, and I wonder if Marion will come along for whatever adventure he has, because she does not seem like someone who should, just be sitting at home and doing nothing while he's out, like, doing
adventure.
Yeah,
but he would not want her to. That's,
and I'd
again,
be okay
his personality.
With her.
Yeah, I'd be okay if her not either.
And she says, I don't care.
After watching, that's one also something that we did not talk about, is Marion's character in this. And I don't know if it's because her acting chops were rusty.
Yeah.
But I was like, oh, shut up.
Like, and as much as I love the moment where she's like, there's too much of it.
Yeah. And I love Marion.
Yeah. And
I don't like Marion.
She didn't, her piece in the puzzle of this film just really wasn't fitting to her. I'm happy that they got together at the end, because I do believe that that is his, you know, he never got over her.
Right.
But yeah, I sort of imagine her sort of being at home while he goes off on his next adventure. But
she gets kidnapped and then he just gets her at the end. Mm-hmm. She gets kidnapped and then the next time we see her,
she's always being kidnapped.
Well, that's all she's good for. Okay, people are good at getting kidnapped.
I mean, my thing is, I think that Short Round should take on the mantle of Indiana Jones going forward, and then you have an Asian American lead. Well, I guess not American, but he's American now. We'd have an Asian lead of an action film, which is a big deal.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
John Cho, I'm sure, is available, even though technically he's not the same ethnicity. But you know what? He does that all the time. Because Sulu, not exactly. He's Korean, right?
He's Korean, yeah.
So, you know what? Apparently Hollywood is okay with it.
But he's aware of it. And he talked to George Takei and was like, what should I do?
Yeah.
Takei was like, yo, you're Asian. This is good.
Well, that's exactly. Like, I've talked about it on the show before.
You're
there's this
Asian culture.
There is this, it's called Starring John Cho, and it's a hashtag, and it's a website, and it's a movement to bring more, you know, male Asian leads. And particularly what it brought up that I did not even think about until I learned more about this movement is that there are very rarely in American cinema are there not only Asian leads, you know, but they're also seen in a romantic way. Mm-hmm. You know, and John Cho is changing that. And so that's why he sort of becomes sort of their figurehead, and they have photoshopped him into posters, and it's a really great thing that they're doing. And so I think this would really be a wonderful step forward for Asian actors if this could happen. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like it's probably going to be Chris Pratt, another white guy.
I mean, I'm just for ending it personally. That's my view of this. My view is you close the book on this, and you know, I highly resent this Solo prequel that they're putting out this year, because I think there are certain characters in fiction you don't recast until like a generation has moved on and you've had space from the actor who portrayed them. And Harrison Ford is just such a big shadow that you're going to have to operate in. And frankly, I think he is Indiana Jones, and they shouldn't be rebooting with new actors until I'm like on my deathbed and people my age have moved on.
I couldn't agree with you more. I absolutely agree. But unfortunately, Frank Marshall has said that it's going to happen. Now, that being said, things change.
Mm.
So if it's going to happen, I would love
to call it Lando.
Say it again.
It should just be Lando.
Yep.
The Solo movie.
Yep. I don't want anything to do with this Alden guy.
I can't stop thinking about it.
All right. Well, what about the idea that, I mean, we're running out of time here, but that was brought up online, which I think is a good point, that if the Han Solo movie fails, there's less of a chance to be an Obi-Wan movie.
Yeah, but that's sad. I'd take an Obi-Wan movie in like
a
second.
Yeah, but that's crazy, because Ewan McGregor's already Obi-Wan, so like that would be totally different. So I hope that doesn't happen.
No, like, it should just have Ewan McGregor as Obi-Wan.
Yes.
Like, older.
Yeah.
Well, here's my issue. It is not a film that I asked for. I don't want people to fail. So I wish them the best of luck, Solo, and I will see it. And I hope that it's good.
I hope it's good, too.
Because I want to always hope for the best. Because as a creative person, I know what that's like to be involved in. I mean, this is a really hard thing to do. It is not easy for anyone involved. I never can say his name, but the lead actor is an amazing actor.
Alden Ehrenreich.
I think so. Yeah, he's wonderful. Lando, obviously amazing casting. So I choose to be positive.
I think that's always it's always a good default stance.
It's going to be hard.
Become one of the negative cesspool people.
I don't want to be a negative cesspool person. Yeah. And you know what? If I don't like it, okay. I don't need to like be offended by it.
I'm not going
to
talk about it.
Yeah.
No. All right.
I think that's spot on. And you know, like, as much as I kind of resent this Solo movie, I'm going to go have a time of my life at opening night watching this movie. And I'm just going to focus on the things I really love, because that's what we do for universes that we just are passionate about. We just get lost in them. And I don't read the reviews. You know, I have my own headcanon review and I move on.
Thank you so much, Steven, for spending the hour with us. Really appreciate it.
Hey, I appreciate you having me on and looping me in to talk about the Crystal Skull, because this movie needs a little bit of support out there in the internet.
I'm glad we got someone that likes it.
Yes, that was why I was excited to bring you on when you said that. You said, I like it. I was like, great, so you're booked.
Well done, Lauren.
Yes.
And Rachel.
Yes.
Bye, y'all.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, so that's it. That's the end of Crystal Skull with Crystal Beth.
Yes. I have a skull.
Oh my God, I have a skull too. It's not Crystal, though.
Crystal Skull. You're just an extra S. If you say it fast enough, it sounds like you're talking about my head. Kingdom of Crystal Skull.
It's all happening in your head.
Yeah, that's where I keep all my personalities.
Why don't you tell everybody where they can find you on social media?
Sure. You can follow me on social media, i.e. Instagram and Twitter, at The Crystal Beth. And then, like I said earlier in the podcast, my other podcasts are on iTunes, The Fifth Element, and Unlimited Lives Radio.
You can find me on Twitter at Lauren Milberger. And if people don't know, this is a really big deal. I'm actually posting on Instagram now.
Oh my gosh.
I know.
That's crazy.
It is crazy. I still catch my tagline, which is, I won't join Instagram, you can't make me, because I think now it's even funnier.
Yes.
So that stays.
Now you're doing it.
I'm doing it. So it's Lauren Milberger, again, M-I-L-B-E-R-G-E-R. You can find The Fordcast on Twitter at The Fordcast PC. You can find us on the Instagrams at The Fordcast Podcast, on Tumblr and Facebook at The Fordcast Podcast. We are also at thefordcastpodcast.com, where you can look at show notes. So we'll put links to all of Crystal Beth's information. We'll also be adding her to our website. So you can, I know it's official.
Oh my gosh, all the perks.
Yeah. So you're really going to be joining us about, on average, about once a month. But next, in 2 weeks, you still will be joining us for Crossing Over.
Yay.
Which, until I started this podcast, didn't know was a Harrison Ford movie.
Yeah, neither did I.
Yeah. We're going to pair it with Extraordinary Measures.
Very good.
Two forgotten Harrison Ford movies. But we will find the memorable parts of it.
Good. We always do.
Everyone probably knows that we have been doing contests. We're not going to bring back the trivia contests, but what we're going to do is, after you've listened to this episode, you can go on our website and enter our contest by putting in the mystery number.
Oh.
It's a new thing. The mystery number today is 5.
That is a mysterious number.
It is.
And then, how do we have 5 fingers? Whales have 5 finger bones. Like, how is this? It's a mystery. It's not. It's evolution.
Will you please do this every time I say this? Because it's sort of ridiculous, but you can sort of make it funny. Because we're almost done. We're almost done with the podcast. And I still have a whole bunch of free stuff.
Oh my gosh, get rid of it.
Yeah. So I'm going to put it together into little sort of bundles. And then each time you're going to enter, and then at the end, you know, based on how many, you know, times you listen and enter, we'll put you into a lottery, and in order that you get picked, you can pick one of these lots. And I'll put pictures of them online as well for people to see. So awesome. They're going to be themed lots of really cool merch from some of our amazing designers who've donated for the last 2 years.
So cool.
Yeah. So we will see you in 2 weeks.
Okay. Bye.
F-O-R-N-D-D.